Hi guys, this is Charles with the Barbershop Group.
And this is Riley, your co-host.
And today we are going to talk to Robert Shaw, or Robbie, from Every Day with Everybody. We had the opportunity to connect with Robbie through Instagram. Woohoo! There we go again with another social media connection, right? But we had the opportunity to connect with him. He does some awesome videos for his audience every day, just talking about some of the squirrely parts of addiction and some of our obsessive compulsive behaviors and just working through that stuff. And let's not pretend, guys, that we don't have addictions. We do. Some of us are battling drug addiction. Some of us may be battling porn addiction and other types of addictions, but let's be real, they exist. So Robbie, how are you today?
I am doing wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for meeting up with us, man. It's awesome to have you here today, and it's also awesome. It's always awesome to be able to connect with someone else working in the field of addictions, because sometimes it feels a little strange when you work in addiction and you're talking to people about it, or especially if you are a recovering addict who works in addiction. People can kind of like look at you as if you're a unicorn or something, right? So today I don't feel that way. Today I don't feel that way. But you know, Robbie, I was thinking about something, man, and you know, I know that you had mentioned that you were kind of just starting to get into some more professional counseling with addiction and everything out there in North Carolina. But like, what motivated you to start to want to go beyond your immediate circle of influence or your immediate circle of friends who are experiencing recovery? What made you want to go beyond that now?
Well, let me tell you exactly what my offering is, mm-hmm. and then we'll go back from there.
Yes,
because I initially started down this path when I got clean almost 12 years ago.
Right.
And I got a master's degree in mental health counseling, and I was set to be a substance abuse counselor. That was what I wanted to do. That was what I felt my calling was. Mm-hmm. I was actually licensed in the state that I received my degree in, because the requirements of the degree were internship hours, and they meshed with the state requirements. So, and that was in the state of Maine a while back. Then I had a daughter about a month after I got my degree. Mm-hmm. And because of my wife's big, bad job, I was by default the stay-at-home father.
Got you.
Which is wonderful, but it pulled me away from my career path.
Yes.
And so I did not practice for 5-6 years raising my daughter. Now, I did do, like you mentioned, a lot of the personal stuff, friends, family, whomever, right. Contacting me for just some guidance and advice. And so fast forward up until, you know, the last maybe 2 years ago, I'm back in North Carolina. I say, all right, Let's get it going again. Let's start going down the path of getting licensed in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Well, the requirements here are very steep. They're steep and a lot tougher than almost every other state except California. Wow. So in order for me to become licensed meant I was going to have to go be an intern for another couple of years.
Wow.
And then I would be an associate license and then have to do, you know, 4,000 hours of, you know, under a not being a full license.
Okay.
All that to say, I became a little demotivated.
Yes.
And then the more I worked with one-on-one type therapy, and not necessarily the one-on-one, it was everything else I had to do in order to do that type of therapy. And you must be familiar, all the paperwork, all the red tape. I mean, all of the junk that prohibits me from doing what I'm fucking passionate about.
Right.
So I just got to this point where I was like, man, what is this really what I want to do? I mean, it kind of is, but it's going to take me 3 more years to get there. And I've already done all this grunt work, mm-hmm. you know? So I sat down with a career life coach and said, let's think outside of the box. Let's look for something else similar, but something different for me to do. And so we came up with an offering of public speaking, discussion leadership, and then we started going down the coaching side of recovery, not therapy, but recovery coaching.
Right.
And I hadn't yet gotten to that point yet. The other stuff was kind of the main part of what I was going to offer. I wanted to be this big public speaker. And I started getting all these calls in from the same type of people I was getting before. And I'll make this quicker. I'm sorry. I'm going on.
It's okay. It's okay. Go ahead.
I'm getting all these calls like I have gotten over the past decade. And a light goes off in my head. And I think the people that are out there seeking help, 9 times out of 10 are the family members and loved ones of the person battling addiction.
Right.
Typically, the person battling is not out there proactive trying to find somebody to help him. You know, that's not the case most of the time. And so I just thought, these are the people. I mean, sometimes it's 5 and 6 people on the phone with me saying, tell me what to do. We do not know what to do with this person.
Right.
And as you know, the response is a wide array of things. It all depends on the situation. It depends on hundreds of different factors as to what you're going to tell them or guide them down which path.
Yes.
And so my company took shape from that moment forward. And now I offer consultation to family members and loved ones and colleagues or whoever is caring or wants to do something about someone that potentially needs help. Mm-hmm. And that involves intervention, mm-hmm. referral, post-care recovery coaching. Mm-hmm. So there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and you know what? And that's kind of like more of the natural. That's more of the natural procession anyway. Because if you think about somebody, if you take somebody who's like in a treatment program, right? First of all, they didn't want to be there. The family wanted them there. And then once they leave, I mean, 9 times out of 10, they're ready to go back out there and score and get back to the life. And and a lot of times, the system isn't set up for that type of aftercare, long-term aftercare. So it's needed, and I'm glad that that trajectory kind of, that door opened up for you, because a lot of people don't see it. In fact, some people who even work in the field, they don't see it that way, because all they see is a revolving door of billable people. They don't think about aftercare on that significant level or beyond. They don't think about all of the family members.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a big piece is, you know, obviously the ultimate goal is the person battling the addiction.
Yes.
That's who we want to rehabilitate. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody else in that person's path is cleaning up the destruction and dealing with the destruction emotionally and externally. And I lived that world for my entire life. I just a raging, abusive alcoholic of a father. Later he got much worse, but the destruction he caused on the family, we're all still suffering from it. And and that's what really takes me to the family to get to the addicted. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a two-part deal. I mean, you know, they're both very sick as a result of one person.
That's right.
So, you know, and as you know this, someone who's addicted is not going to get help until they, you know, decide they want it or need it or have to have it or have no other option. You know, it's that rock bottom. But a lot of times the family can either further along that rock bottom, whether it's pull away from the person or ultimatums and interventions. And, you know, there's lots of different methods, mm-hmm. but usually it's the closest ones to the person that can push it along faster.
Right.
Right. Or at least even convince the person that they might even exercise the possibility of getting help. I mean, it's just, you never know. There's a lot to it.
Yeah.
Well, Robbie, I gotta say, I think it's great the work that you're doing. And, you know, a lot of times I don't come from an addiction counseling background, but I do come from a counseling background and had some social work experience. And honestly, a lot of people in that field, I think they need help too. And a lot of times the helpers need help. And
right.
most often that turns into the family of people struggling with, substance abuse. But I'm really curious, in your experience and from your perspective, what makes it so difficult? What makes it so hard for the individuals themselves to reach out? Like you said, that 9 times out of 10, it's the family or it's, it's someone else. It's not the addict themselves. Mm-hmm. And you said you got to hit rock bottom. Like, what is that? Can you add more to that?
Good Lord. Now we're defining, individuals' unique addictions and, I love talking about it because it's an ongoing, it'll never be blanket statement. It'll never be a black and white definition as to why someone becomes addicted. I don't know. Why do they not? It's the definition of addiction is repeating the same behavior despite the consequences despite the negative consequences. And, why would you in your right mind do that? Well, in that little area, you're not in your right mind. And there is an insanity involved with it that involves cravings and the science and the biology of the body and external factors that have molded your personality and your reactions and so much involved as to why someone reaches, those points. And it is so progressive. I like to think about, early on, because it's really a preventative type strategy. When we get into this field, we've got to clean up the mess as therapists and as people who are working with those that are suffering. But there's also a duty, in my opinion, to assist in the prevention of it. The education, get these kids early and, all that kind of stuff. And so there's a really interesting aspect there as to how to help someone become aware of where this is going to lead, where it 9 times out of 10 leads, and how far it goes when it begins going that right. way.
Yeah. And unfortunately, yeah. We can't always prevent,
Not
bad
always,
stuff
no.
from happening. And I think that, maybe something to break it down. I want to break it down a little bit more, especially for the listeners, because it's not only, people struggling with addictions, but I think just men in general have a really difficult time asking for help.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think there's obviously the sociological aspect to that, the traditional machismo,
right.
It's all about control, right? I was speaking with a buddy of mine recently and so many things had happened and it was impossible for them to recognize that, part of this addiction was I think a major part of actual addiction is the admission that you have lost control over something external. And I think the man has or being a man has a big play in that. Like you mentioned, not only addiction. I mean, they do that elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But then you throw in, the complex characteristics of being addicted to a substance, and you are, the denial sets in. I'm smart. This does not have a control over me. I will always be able to handle this. I know I wrecked my car. I know I did this. Got 4 DUIs. I've been in jail. I got all that, but I can control it if I need to.
Right. It's funny. It's funny because if you think about being a man, right? So you've got on your suit of armor already.
Okay. Already.
Before any obsessive compulsive behavior, before any addiction, you already have on your suit of armor. Forget about the fact that suit of armor is probably made out of plastic anyway, okay? Or some type of onion thin skin.
Right.
And you've got it, okay? So now you add another component to it in addiction, okay? So you have a guy who's already pretending to be a certain way, and then you've got addiction added to it. Oh my goodness. So I was pretending to be a certain way and I didn't like that. And I've added addiction to it. And now I'm another way. I like the feeling, but it's really messing me up. And before you know it, this person doesn't know how to get out of that hole by themselves, okay? A lot of men, even without addiction, don't know how to climb out of the hole of toxic masculinity or of that fake armor. And so when you talk about a guy who's like, hey, I can control it if I need to, you know, we run into people all the time who are trying to use their intellect or their rationale to explain their behavior. And it's like, okay, since you can explain it, then just stop doing it. Right. And all of a sudden it's like, and it's another tactic and another barrier. And before you know it, it's like they've got you, you know, chasing them around because they're chasing their own tail around and it just never ends. And that's kind of who we are as men. And that's why the barbershop group and other things like it are extremely important, because I think that beyond substance abuse, I think that we men use or misuse a lot of things inappropriately, okay? Because we have difficulty confronting things as they are, all right? So I think that in some cases, men are using women inappropriately because they can't confront who they are, right? I think in some cases, men could potentially use sports inappropriately because they can't confront who they are. I mean, let's face it. Let's say you've got a son and this son plays football and he took a hard hit and you know what, he got the crap knocked out of him and he got up crying or wincing and you're like, dude, what the hell is wrong with you? No, what the hell is wrong with you? you know, like your son took the hit and you're making him feel like a piece of crap. You insensitive bastard, you, what are you going through? And I think that today in 2018, men are being forced to actually look at this thing. And because a lot of men are being forced to look at this thing, we also see huge balloons of denial in a lot of men. A lot of men, if you listen to them, instead of them actually engaging in the conversation, they're either withdrawing from conversations or they're belittling people in conversations. Mm-hmm. And that tells you what that little inner child is really, really doing.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we talk about addictions, I mean, yeah, they're the traditional addictions, but then there are all these other things that we men have been using that we don't really consider like part of addictive behavior, and they are.
Right. Well, I mean, using is a symptom, right?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, it's not really like when somebody's in that pattern of use, wanting them to wake up or do something to get out of it on their own, it's, man, yeah, that's very, very difficult. And it sucks that a lot of times you have to hit rock bottom, you know, to get there. I always tell the story of, I'll never forget, when Mike Tyson got out of jail, when he got out of prison, who was he fighting? He was fighting...
Where he bit the ear?
Yeah, it was Holyfield. See, and I need help remembering that. And you know why I need help remembering that?
During that time.
Let me tell you something, okay? I remember... meeting up with a bunch of guys, getting ready for the fight, loading up my hatchback with a lot of alcohol. And by the time the fight got started, I was gone. And I also, the only thing that I know was that I couldn't find my keys and my knee was very swollen because, as they told me, a girl was jumping up and down on me on a chair. The chair broke. She fell on my knee. You see what I'm saying? But dude, but if you talked to me at that time, I was just pissed that my friends took my keys.
Yeah.
But I wasn't pissed because I was drunk and they took my keys. They told me they were going to get more alcohol. And I'm like, dude, where's my car and where's the alcohol?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. So
it's amazing how the mind that stuff can really, you know, really trip you out. So that's really interesting, man. So here's a question I have for you, Robbie. You know, let's talk about addiction today. And you're in North Carolina, and you know, I won't say much yet, but this opioid crisis, okay, that everybody's talking about. Personally, I feel like it's a little bit misplaced, but I won't say why as of yet. But you know, do you have a lot of people calling you, getting in touch with you about this opioid crisis right now?
You know, so far, no. But I went through it. Mm-hmm. So I quit drinking almost 12 years ago. Okay. I ruptured a disc in my back about 6 years ago. I'm a basketball player, college player, still play, that whole deal. And blew out my back and got hooked on the pills. Mm. And then found, you know, the dealer and had fought that for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So, you know, I understand it, mm-hmm. obviously from a personal level. But I don't know where you're going with it. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Yeah. So as far as phone calls and me working with others on it, I have not seen that much yet. It is usually alcohol, and then everybody's always like, well, he does some other shit too, but it's always, yeah. No, I got it.
That's kind of how it goes. So the reason why I asked that is, you know, several years ago, I lost a good friend of mine to heroin. Mm-hmm. And this was a friend who had also introduced me to the use of painkillers, just to kind of, you know, I was an athlete too, a couple aches and pains here. Hey, dude, just take this. You know, I was working in an environment where it was readily available. And it was like, hey, dude, just take this, right? And lo and behold, man, years later, got a phone call from him about 3 a.m. in the morning. And he sounded like everything was okay. We would just catch it up. And by 10 a.m. that next morning, his cousin was calling me saying that, hey, his wife found him dead on the couch with a needle in his arm. And I'm like, that's not a pill. What the hell? Right? And we would always talk about the progression of things, but he swore up and down that he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. For me, the attention to the opioid situation, it's great. But it also kind of like turned the knife in me because of the personal experience of losing a friend and losing a friend years ago. So I'm like, dude, when did it just become, it didn't just become an issue. It's been around. Okay. Oh, let's stop acting like it's brand new because it's not.
No.
Okay. And the other thing that's bothersome to me about the attention that's given to it is that it seems to be that, like, okay, now we've got a crisis. And I'm like, no, America, there's always been a drug crisis that we've wanted to overlook. Mm-hmm. Right? And it feels like we tend to appropriate it here or there, or we add some political and social pieces to it, and then it becomes a problem for us. So for me, I do get a lot of calls about the opioid issue. It's all people really want to talk about in this area. You can't go a block without finding a pharmacist, okay? You can't go a block. And no one thought at the time, hey, is there anything wrong with this? I mean, you literally have pharmacies a block apart. And now a lot of them are being shut down. Okay. But the reality is they didn't start doing this overnight. They've been doing this for a long time. Okay. And it's just coming to light. One of the things that I like that you said about addressing the family is that, you know, everybody's hurting. And I've learned in my work in addictions that a lot of time we have some family members who don't want to participate in the counseling. They don't want to participate in the addict's treatment. And I'm like, what in the world? And I don't know if you've ever had that happen, right? But you look up and it's like, well, do you want them to get better? Do you want them to get better? And they're like, yeah, but I'm just tired of dealing with it.
Yeah.
But as you start to like really delve into things, you learn that sometimes family members have caused that addict a lot of pain that they don't really want to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And I always say, hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that makes confronting addiction difficult as well, is because, you know, our stuff bumps into other people's stuff. And we get to a point where we may want the addict to take responsibility for their stuff, but sometimes it's difficult for everybody else to do it, you see. So, you know, that's just a little bit of my soapbox about addiction and things, man, but it's something that I definitely experience. And I'm just curious to know what your experience has been regarding that.
Man, I mean, that's par for the course, you know? I mean, rarely are you talking to a family where everybody's all right over here and we got one person with a problem. I mean, that's never the case. You know, I mean, I think when you're working with families, especially families, I mean, even down to the individual, it's always unique. I mean, it's simple and it's complicated. You know, the simple part is you need to stop. And you need right. to do what it takes to stop. That's the keep it simple, stupid. That's where all the little things come from. And, you know, all you got to do is just not do it. And that's, you know, that's simple. But yeah. when you want to get into why it all happened and where it came from and what turned here and there, and, you know, then it gets really complicated. And it, you know, more times than not involves multiple family members.
Right.
You know, so I was asked to speak to the eighth grade at my daughter's school about 3 weeks ago or so, and they have a substance abuse night, and all the parents come, and the kids are there, and the staff are there, and they have somebody present and do a little education on part of it, and then they have somebody share a story, and then we break off into discussion groups, and I was the one doing the presentation.
Okay.
And I don't really love doing educational presentations. I like to get up and just, you know, jive with everybody. I come from a, you know, improv comedy background, and I like to go.
Yeah.
And so they give me this, you know, 17-page, you know, presentation that I got to hit all these points, and I didn't love it. So I threw in a lot of my own stuff. And they liked it, and fortunately it was well received. But all to say, one of my biggest messages was, and we are talking to eighth graders, so a lot of this is preventative. It is education, and it is, you know, let's talk about the reality of this stuff. And what it boiled down to when you're talking to parent and child at once is how effective the communication is between them.
Right.
Regarding this topic, and it's, you know, this is a particular demographic, so it's I'll say it this way: there were no homeless people in there, so it's a different kind of niche, I guess. So we're talking communication, we're talking trust, we're talking all these different ways for, because the parents are like, well, what do we do? How do we talk to them, and what do we say, and how they don't listen, and I'm like, so. My big message came down to lead by example.
Yes.
It's pretty simple. It makes sense. You know, obviously that would be a very effective way to do it. But if we were to examine every single family that was in that room, I would probably say none of you are doing a good job.
Mm.
You know, they all drink.
Right.
We all, you know, it's, and it boils down to exactly what you're talking about, just maybe a different dynamic as far as parent child, but you can't have someone telling another what to do or even advising and suggesting what to do when they're not doing it themselves.
Right.
That's right. Never works. It in fact usually has the opposite effect.
That's right.
Especially with a parent child, the child is going to say, "Fuck that! I'm going to go do exactly what you said. Don't do." And you know, and my dad used to say, you know, he would tell me the things he tried, and because of our relationship, and there wasn't a bunch of trust, and there wasn't a bunch of me listening. Whatever he said, he did gave me a green light.
Right.
Well, I get to do that.
Yeah.
And that was a lot.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that gets down to you.
Well, you know, the cultural, I think too, we do a bad job in America of like looking at the intersection of addiction and culture or environment. You know, I just talked to a lady, I think maybe a week ago, her son was sent to a rehab facility about an hour away from here. And this is his ninth rehab, his ninth. Okay. But wait, he's only 25. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Ninth rehab. He's 25 years old. He's going to these private rehabilitation centers and I'm just shaking my head.
Yeah.
No, that's enough.
Okay. Stopped at four.
Yeah. That's enough. And his parents are spending a lot of this money trying to get him to rehab. And I have to say, look, unfortunately, those fancy rehab things like that, save them. Okay. Save them. Because if you can't be clean in the environment that you're going back to, okay, and if the people around you are not clean, yeah. The luck, you're not going to have it. Okay. And so I just, again, culturally, I think that we have a disconnect. We think that we can do all of these things, but yet somehow we're going to produce children or citizens who are not addicts. And it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't really work that way. And that's just, I think that's stepping on a lot of toes, and I get that because, you know, who doesn't want to go out to the bar and have a drink or come home from work and throw one back and what have you. But, dude, I mean, that's really what it is. That's really what it is. I think mom and dad or mom in a lot of cases, right? And then beyond that, if guys go to college, we can talk about the alcohol and things like that in college, but it's always around. Okay, these drugs are always around. And then music and pop culture do a lot too, right? Especially today, where if you've got a, you know, 50 greatest hits of 2017, you may have half of them that glorify drinking and the use of other drugs, right? So, and then you know that because it's pop culture, it's something that the children are listening to. And a lot of times it's something that the parents are listening to.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So yeah, communication and the conversations have to change regarding addiction. That's extremely, extremely important. I wanted to start to wrap up, Robbie, but I know that people they're able to reach you on Instagram at Every Day with Everybody, right? And you also have the website up now.
Website's up and there's contact information there.
Awesome. That's really good to hear. I know that a lot of individuals may stray away from reaching out to addicts for help. It you know, a lot of times when you're a recovering addict or something like that, again, people think that you're this Cyclops kind of person or whatever. But one of the good things, guys, about really confronting or speaking with addictions counselors and things like that is that they aren't going to mince words. That's extremely important. They're not going to dance around. And you're laughing, but you know it's,
there will be no dancing.
There's no dance. Nobody's got time for it. You know, if there's somebody that's going down the wrong path, then they're gonna hear it. It's like, you know, cut the shit, cut it now. because that's what it is. You know, the only person that's hurting the most is you, and okay, bye. You know, if you're going to die like this, guess what? You're going to die alone. And well, hey, but it's just a different way of communicating. But a message that I want to put out there for men who may be dealing with drugs and alcohol is that you don't have to wait to get better. Okay, guys. And you and I both know that if somebody else is twisting your arm to get better, you're not going to get any better. Okay. If you guys are out there and you got a DUI and you got to go to court appointed therapy or something like that, yeah, that's probably not going to fix you. Okay. You're going to have to admit that you're powerless over this thing. You're going to have to admit that you don't know what the hell you're doing by yourself. And you're going to have to really, really engage in getting help. And again, that doesn't just apply to addiction. It applies to a lot of things. We cannot do this life alone. A man on an island is not a man at all. Okay. You may think you are, but if you really go in a room and sit down and do some self-inventory, you will, you'll have to be honest with yourself. Okay. Robbie, it was great speaking with you today. Again, guys, you can contact Robbie on Instagram or his website, Every Day with Everybody, and check him out. We really enjoy your videos in the morning. I know Instagram makes it really short for you, but
chopped up.
Right. We enjoy the work that you're doing, man. Keep doing it. We need more people like you who are doing it, and we thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, keep in touch with us, and we support the work that you're doing. And, man, as always, just keep your head in the game. You know?
Thank you. I love what you all are doing as well. It's, you know, throughout this interview or conversation, I've just been thinking about what y'all do and how no matter who you are, what you got going on, the only way to get through it is to open up about it or admit it or look at it or examine it. And, you know, there's lots of people out there that may think that their life is 100% perfect, but
yes, no.
We all know it ain't. So the quicker you can see it and the quicker you can share it with somebody, the quicker it's going to get better. And it's, I love that you're providing a,
Absolutely. Well, we're trying. Okay. Well, we're going to let you go. And guys, I hope that you have enjoyed the conversation with Robbie and Riley and myself today. If you like to, you can visit us and make a contribution at www.patreon.com/thebarbershopgroup. It helps us continue the podcast and have awesome guests on the show. And it's all for a good cause. So please help us out if you can. In the meantime, we hope that you guys will have a great day, and we will talk to you soon.
The Barbershop Group provides safe spaces for men to discuss issues of well-being and mental health. The Barbershop Group also serves as a resource to the community, providing consultations and public speakers through partnerships with attorneys, mental health professionals, family agencies, religious institutions, and other advocates. In the near future, the Barbershop Group seeks to renovate dilapidated residential and commercial properties in urban areas to create respite shelters for displaced men. We will also host mentorship retreats and workshops for young men and adults to foster growth through our Iron Sharpening Iron and our Rebuilding Men programs. In addition, we host a weekly podcast covering issues of mental health, homelessness, financial literacy, education, and leadership. If you would like to be a guest on our show, please email us at info@thebarbershopgroup.org. Visit our Facebook page or call 313-585-9948 for more information.